This hour, we're marking the beginning of the Talking Volumes season by listening back to one of my favorite interviews from last season. Stacy Schiff is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian who wrote the best-selling biography, Cleopatra, A Life. She came to Talking Volumes in November to talk about her newest book, The Witches, Salem, 1692. And the book comes out in paperback next week. It puts the New England witch trials in the social context of early America. Stacy Schiff began the conversation by noting that the allure of witches never died off after the trials in the 1600s, and that, in fact, witches remain a pervasive part of our culture.
In literature, in opera, all the really good roles seem to go to witches. I mean, what does that tell us?
What does that tell us?
You know, I think, in part, this is how I came, you know, in that strange, convoluted, perverse way that one gets from Cleopatra to 17th century America, which is perfectly obvious to me. When you talk about women and you talk about power, somehow the word witchcraft automatically seems to arise between the two. And in fact, even today, if you look at the press, whenever you have a woman who is said to be very accomplished or spellbinding, or she's never charismatic, she's spellbinding.
I mean, right.
The sorceress stuff seems to come up a lot.
Right. These women that were in 1692 in Salem that were accused or feeling like they were experiencing witchcraft were taking on a kind of power and self-authority, right? That must have been very threatening to the community.
Many of the people who are accused are clearly, you know, it's hard to say because there are male witches, there are all kinds of people accused, but many of the women who are accused are clearly the sharp-tongued, the sharp-elbowed, the defiant, the cantankerous, the woman who didn't quite fit in or who perhaps was a little less conciliatory than she might have been. The woman who asked the carpenter to actually fix that joint three times over as opposed to just paying the bill. She got accused of witchcraft.
That quote that I read in the introduction about the more you resisted an accusation of witchcraft, the deeper you dug yourself in. There was really no way out for a while.
The peculiarity of the witchcraft accusations in 1692 is that you're being accused of deeds that happen in someone else's imagination, basically. You're being accused by a core group of girls who seem to have some kind of spectral sight. And so you could be standing in a courtroom and think that you're simply standing before the justices, but the girls will point at you and claim that you are conversing with an invisible devil whom they alone can see. And for various reasons, which we can talk about, the justices will privilege their testimony over yours. So the justices will somehow seem also able to see or believe that they see this spectral figure whispering in your ear. So if you're up against something that no one else has to prove, you have no alibi. And essentially what happens under those circumstances, yes, is that your case is hopeless.
As you're explaining that, I'm thinking, if you look into more contemporary history and you think about witch hunts, it's not all that dissimilar. If you were believed to be a communist, you had to prove a negative at one point in our country. I mean, there's other eras like this.
I think in any situation where you are said to be something that you are not, and are not given the means to deny that, yes, it involves some sort of witchcraft. The difference I would point out is that there were communists. There presumably were no witches.
Okay.
So,
presumably,
some of
you
us
said.
Believe. I tend to believe there were no witches. But in other words, in some cases, these are overstated threats. In some cases, these are delusional threats. And this is a case of a religious idea taken one step too far in a situation where, for different reasons and because of different people's agendas, the prosecution is ruthless and absolutely across the board hell-bent on doing what it's doing.
Sexuality simmers through a lot of this, and I think at one point you say, the battle for a thrashing, moaning young woman's soul certainly titillated some at her bedside. How present was this simmering sexuality that nobody was really going to be open about?
Here you have me out on a speculative ledge. These are teenaged accusers. These are all girls between the ages of 12 and 20, accusing their elders, accusing men in the community. Nothing on paper connects any of those girls with any kind of sexual abuse. Many of them are orphans. Many of them are living in homes without their biological fathers. On the court records in the prior years, there's a tremendous history of sexual assault. Any number of women battle, you know, the lascivious swineherd or the other servant in the house. Servants are abused by their masters regularly. So there's a lot of violence against women in this society. If you look at the girls' testimony carefully, a lot of very sexualized vocabulary gets used. The girls are poked, they're prodded, their pitchforks are thrown on them, people have wrestled them onto their laps. There's a lot that's sexual. I mean, there's one point where the girls in the courtroom tended to convulse and to fall into trances and to writhe or to have their limbs go rigid. And there's one spectacular moment of a teenaged girl in the courtroom with her legs sort of soldered together, and you have these adult men trying to separate her knees. I mean, a lot of this is slightly sexual. So do I see an undercurrent there? Yes. Do we have any definitive proof that any of these girls was acting out of any kind of, you know, abuse? Not really. There's an interesting piece in the testimony where the girls are clearly accusing a man, in this case a minister of witchcraft, and he's said to be the wizard who's at the heart of this whole conspiracy, who had abused his wives. And it's almost, and everyone in the community knew that he had been a combative figure and a very difficult husband, a very controlling husband. And this is clearly some kind of vengeance being worked on him by women for the women whom he had abused. So there are all kinds of levels of sexuality here.
What did you make of the fact that a number of these girls that were accused witches were living without fathers? Did you draw any conclusion from that?
I think there's a lot to it. Partly in the sense that you are just vulnerable in a society like this one, where a father figure would have meant so much. There's a stunning case of a girl who's bewitched the following year, who is suffering the symptoms of witchcraft in 1693, and she is surrounded in her bedroom by well-wishers, which was normal under the circumstances. And at one point, she dismisses all the women, but she asks the men to stay. And there seemed to be a lot of that. There's another girl who will converse with an invisible devil, and she's saying to the devil, stop telling me that I'm fatherless. I know that I'm fatherless. So there seems to be a certain obsession with having lost that male protector in some way.
I get the impression from reading some of the testimony that includes descriptions of the devil that it was a very traditional, almost medieval kind of perception of what the devil was. Is that how you'd put it?
Yes, I would say that there is no, it's not the Miltonian devil. There are no sort of winged creatures here. The devil seems to be a relatively traditional figure. He can transform himself into all kinds of animals. No one's quite sure what language he speaks. There's a lot of confusion as to whether he's a dark man or whether he's a dark cat. You know, he's a transformative figure in many ways. He clearly is related in some way. An earlier witchcraft epidemic in Sweden colors what will happen in New England. And the New England devil in 1692 bears a striking similarity to the Swedish devil of several decades earlier. So there's a little imported devilology, or whatever you want to call it, there. And there's a certain consistency to his agenda in that he's offering his diabolical packs. Everyone's very clear that he offers a little book. It's usually red. One signs in blood or in red or with the bark of a tree. But he proffers all kinds of fine things. And it's interesting that those are sort of customized bribes. I mean, he knows exactly what you want, of course. So to a middle-aged woman, he might offer ease and rest. And to a child, he might offer fine clothes or a trip to the Golden City. He pretty much knows what you're what you're lusting for.
That's, you're listening to Stacey Schiff. She's a historian with me at Talking Volumes last November, talking about her book, The Witches Salem, 1692. The book comes out in paperback next week, and we're playing the show because Talking Volumes kicks off the whole big new season on Thursday. So more from Stacey Schiff of Talking Volumes in just a minute, but the latest news now from Phil Picardi. Phil, what's at the top of the news hour here?
Hi, Carrie. The former State Department computer specialist who was assigned to set up the private email server Hillary Clinton used while Secretary of State has refused a subpoena to appear before a House panel. Brian Pagliano was scheduled to testify today before the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Jason Chaffetz of Utah, the committee's Republican chair, says there will be consequences for thumbing his nose at Congress. Hillary Clinton says she supports the decision by the NCAA to pull 7 championship events from the state of North Carolina. The move was prompted by a state law some say can lead to discrimination against gays. In a tweet, Clinton says it was the right move. The NCAA's move follows the state's passage of a law requiring transgender people to use bathrooms that match the sex listed on birth certificates. The mother of a man accused of attempting to shoot Donald Trump has told British television he will plead guilty to lesser charges in the U.S. Lynn Sanford, the mother of Michael Sanford, told ITV News her son has signed a plea agreement in advance of a Nevada court appearance today. Sanford was accused after an incident at a Trump rally in June in which he allegedly tried to grab a policeman's gun to attack Donald Trump. The company developing the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline says it is committed to the project. This despite strong opposition and a federal order to halt construction near an American Indian reservation in North Dakota. The CEO of Energy Transfer Partners says in a memo to employees the 4-state project is nearly complete. The Standing Rock Sioux is suing federal regulators for approving the oil pipeline. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:30.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, an update to the story last year about large numbers of untested rape kits in police storage throughout Minnesota. How are departments addressing that, and how does that affect solving crimes? Join us at 11.
Programming supported by the Placemakers Rochester Prototyping Festival, where the possibilities for transforming public spaces are endless. September 15th through 17th on historic 3rd Street in downtown Rochester. Learn more at downtownrochestermn.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and the thread question of the week is coming at the end of the hour. It's about F. Scott Fitzgerald. You'll want to catch that. Right now, we're listening to my Talking Volumes interview from last November with Stacey Schiff. It's about her book, The Witches Salem, 1692. One of the things that I found really absorbing about the book is you're telling us about the economic and political circumstances that would have led people to be interested in the pact of the devil, to believe in some of these accounts of witchcraft, to feel isolated and afraid.
I couldn't get over how much of a state of siege these people are living in.
Right.
And how unfamiliar any of us is, I think, with what was happening in New England in 1692. I, anyway, knew relatively little of the political context, which plays a huge role here. And you're not even a generation after a really traumatic and bloody Indian war. Everyone either has lost a relative or knows someone who has lost a relative in the prior Indian war, and a new Indian conflict has begun. So the feeling that an Indian raid could take place at any moment is very real, and the frontier is about 50 miles from Salem Village at this point. So the sense that the world around you is in a state of dislocation and that menace is in the air is very pronounced.
I think it would be helpful to kind of describe the geography of, as you say, the frontier was 50 miles away. Salem Village is also removed.
Salem Village is a tiny community of farmers. It's about 550 people. 5 miles away from Salem Town, just to confuse the issue. You know, the thing with the Puritans is they always use the same names. Like, everyone in this book is named Mary. I'm really sorry, but there was nothing I could do about that. And there are two Salems. Salem Town, which is the seaport, it's a very refined port, quite wealthy, second only to Boston. And 5 miles away, is a little village to which farmers have removed themselves in search of better land. They have no authorities. They have no civic institutions of their own. They rely on Salem Village to adjudicate their matters, which creates a certain amount of tension. And it is in that village of pretty much isolated households that the witchcraft will break out.
They've removed themselves, you say, to find better land, but isn't there also a feeling of not wanting to be controlled, I guess, by what's going on in Salem Town?
There's a terrific tension between the two that will come out during the trials.
Right.
In the sense of the farmers, for example, saying, why should we go to Salem Town to help keep the watch? We're the ones who are living on the frontier. The menace is at our front doors. And the town is really not very forgiving of the villagers for that defiance. So that going into the trials, there's a certain impatience with these combative, feisty, rather independent-minded farmers.
I want to talk about the perception of what a witch was, because this was really interesting. And you write about the influence that an English academic had over the idea of what a witch was in the 17th century. They would have, it's clear that they would have believed that witchcraft was very tangible, that you could, see it and feel it?
And that was really important for me to get across early on in the book. Yes, very palpable, but not a witch is not a figure of superstition at this point. A witch is a religious construct, and she is essentially, he or she is someone who is essentially signed a pact with the devil, because of which she can do unnatural and malicious things. And she has a whole army of little familiars or imps which help her to accomplish her ends. But she's defined, there's an entire scientific literature of witchcraft to the point where all kinds of things about her are codified. The marks that she bears on her body are codified. Everyone knew that a witch couldn't recite the Lord's Prayer properly. And oddly enough, when any number of suspects appear in the courtroom and are asked to recite the Lord's Prayer, they can't do it, which drives home the kind of pressure these people were under in front of the authorities. A witch could not cry except for 3 tears out of her left eye. I mean, it's really specific material. And an English witch was different from a continental witch, and these are very much English witches, who did not fly until 1692, when there's a lot of flying in Massachusetts, which is another import from the Swedish epidemic. But yes, there's an entire science and literature of this. And a witch is not the pointy-headed crone we know today, but a diabolical accomplice.
You talk about the contradictory dimensions of what a witch could do and couldn't do. You say, they knew secrets for bleaching cloth, smelled figs in someone else's pocket, survived falls downstairs. They could be muttering contentious malcontents, or they could be inexplicably strong and unaccountably smart. You could not win if you were.
Some of us would be toast, yeah.
I know.
There's a wonderful line said by her minister of the first woman to have hanged in Massachusetts, that she had had more wit than her neighbors.
Yes.
A hanging offense, in many circumstances, in fact. Those who were outliers, those who were oddities, even the minister whom I just mentioned, George Burroughs, he was a very small man. He's called Puny by one of the great Massachusetts ministers, but he has some kind of sinewy strength, and it doesn't seem as if it correlates to his size. And that seems, while that had seemed very impressive during Indian raids in 1692, when you're looking for a diabolical mastermind, it seemed suspect. So anybody who's on the margins in any way, among other people, is definitely suspect.
I want you to tell us the story of, how do you pronounce, Tituba? Tituba?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She's accused by a 12-year-old girl. I was just talking with somebody in the audience who is going to ask a question about the Crucible, but she shows up, right, in Arthur Miller's.
She does. She shows up in a slightly different form. There's some wonderful scholarship about Tituba, who starts out in the historic version, in the real version, the original version, she's an Indian slave. By the time Arthur Miller writes The Crucible, she has become African-American. How that is accomplished is slightly complicated, but in 1692, she is an Indian slave living in the house of the minister where the witchcraft breaks out. And she's one of the first three people accused of witchcraft. First, the first three people accused are the three sort of obvious suspects. It's Tituba, it's a very contentious woman who tends to sue a lot, and it's a homeless beggar woman. So three relatively vulnerable people are the first accused. Tituba does something which arguably ignites the entire hunt or panic, whatever you want to call it. She confesses, and she's the first to say, yes, I've met with the devil in the parsonage, in fact. I've had these discussions with the devil. He's promised me these things. I have flown with him. A conspiracy is afoot, and there are nine witches in all. And, of course, as soon as she has confessed to witchcraft, all kinds of people begin to see all kinds of things. Suddenly there's a reality to these accusations, and no one is then able to deny the fact that witchcraft is at work. Oddly, Tituba will go to jail after that testimony, and so far as I can tell, is never appealed to again in the course of the entire panic. She's the first into jail and the last one out 15 months later in 1693, when we lose all trace of her.
These accounts of people that are accused and confess, it's so, again, so relevant to modern history in some ways, because what are we learning about the criminal justice system? People say, well, why would they confess if they didn't do it? I mean, I'm amazed at how relevant a lot of this history is. Were you?
And every day I would pick up the newspaper and think either I have become simple-minded and I'm completely monomaniacal, or this is very relevant.
Right.
Or all of the above, exactly.
Right.
But the false confessions are definitely, a part of this. I was writing some of this during Guantanamo days. It's strangely easy to exact a false confession, and sometimes a very detailed, in these cases, false confession. There were a lot of reasons for it in 1692, which were not, which are rather original reasons for it. Sometimes people confessed because they were afraid of being thrown into the dungeon with George Burroughs, the minister I was just talking about, because even the people who believe themselves to be innocent think the other accused witches are guilty. So the idea that you could be thrown into the dungeon with a wizard was more terrifying even than confessing to witchcraft. Sometimes people, there's a teenage girl who rides off to her hearing with her minister on one side of her and her brother on the other, and both the men are saying to her as they ride, admit it, you're a witch. And the young girl saying, of course I'm not a witch. And of course, by the time they get to the hearing, she's admitted that she's a witch. A lot of people confess at a certain point because if you do so, you don't tend to hang. So it's a way to save your life. And a lot of people confess because, as many of us do, they have stains on their consciences.
Right.
And when they confess, what comes out is not only diabolical collusion, but a bout of drinking or an episode of adultery or a theft or a polygamy, or there are other little peccadilloes that come tumbling out.
I thought some of those confessions were just heart-wrenching. You can imagine the terror.
Yes.
And as you say, people who have done something that in this day and age would not be something to be ashamed of, but they're living with this sense of shame, and how exploitive.
Well, I was struck too by two things: how exploitive, how everyone has something on his or her conscience,
right?
But also how
that's what we're going to talk about a little later in the have people
you'll
stand
all,
up.
You'll all be filling out little cards, sending them up here,
that's
and
right.
Then we're going to point fingers. That's why you're here tonight,
exactly,
and not at the hockey game. And also how everybody has something on someone else,
right?
The New England memory, except when it comes to 1692, is a very long memory. And people tend to remember generations old, this is very true of an oral culture, obviously, generations old grievances and litigation. And a lot of things come tumbling out in 1692 that reach back 10 and 20 and 30 and 40 years.
Do you think that's still true to a certain degree of kind of societies we live in?
I live in a New York City apartment building, and I have to tell you, we don't forget easily what happened on the seventh floor.
Really? I mean, you reminded me that, you know, that's how the Stasi stayed in business for as long as they did, terrorizing people so deeply that they would easily turn on anybody, including people in their family. There was some of that here going on in Salem.
There's a great deal of, you can feel the contagion of the terror.
Right.
And you can feel it to the point where you begin to see, or suspect anyway, that people are accusing because it's, if they accuse, they know they won't be in turn be accused, which I think is very parallel to East Germany.
Right.
That you had the feeling that you were safer if you simply name. There were two reasons to name a name. You were safer. It was a great way of protecting yourself. And communal purity was essential. And it was your moral obligation, if you had a suspicion of your neighbor or of someone else in the community, to name names.
Let's say a little bit more about this idea of communal purity. I mean, is it something that the people that... would they have recognized as such among themselves? How was it thought of in the community?
By all means. And the minister in whose household this breaks out also inflames matters by making it clear that there are some, as he puts it, devils in the church. And essentially, in a finger-pointing sermon, calls on his parishioners to help expunge those individuals without naming names. But it does give one the sense that there are people who need to be sacrificed for the sake of the rest of the community. But it's central to Puritanism that for you to be pure, someone else had to be impure.
That's right. I mean, did they have the sense that they were living to a code that was higher and purer than people in other parts of America at that time?
I would say that you can see American exceptionalism pretty much being born in this moment.
Yeah.
For better or worse. The same kind of defiance and feistiness that you see giving us a revolution in 1776, you see at work in 1692 when the ministers, rather encouraging a witch panic, indicate that it isn't necessarily such a bad thing that the devil has touched down in Massachusetts because it's a sort of badge of honor. And it's proof that New Englanders are the chosen people. So this invasion of diabolical agents serves two purposes. It indicates that this is the greatest, most pious settlement in the world. Where will the devil go but there where he is hated most, says Cotton Mather.
I was just going to say, isn't that something Cotton Mather believes?
Of course, everything's something Cotton Mather believes. Yeah. That's why I love him so. And as many ministers had for years been prophesying the Second Coming, which was going to be preceded by diabolical spirits, here was proof that the Second Coming, about which also the ministers had been very exact in terms of dates, was afoot, because this was the plague that was going to beckon it into existence.
It's so intriguing to think of you pressing these librarians for the specific details of where the moon was.
Okay, you want to know, it's even worse than that, because not only did I hound this poor and brilliant New York Public Library research librarian about the moon, but then I realized that in these 55 confessions to a diabolical Sabbath, which is where poor Anne Foster was flying when her pole crashed, no one ever said it was dark. So how disappointing is that? Not only are they not flying on a broom, they're flying on a pole, but it's not even dark out.
This could have been during the day?
It was presumably during the day, because
really?
They all confess to seeing. I mean, everyone is very big on the colors and the details, so they're clearly able to see. So yes, this, it would seem as if this manufactured Sabbath with the long table and the tankards and the sort of reverse communion ceremony takes place in broad daylight.
It's interesting that the flying is such a constant element through some of these accounts, right?
Well, as I said, it's new to New England. Continental witches flew, English witches traditionally did not fly. And the flying takes off, Tituba mentions it, and then no one really picks up on it for a little bit of time. And by midsummer, suddenly everyone is on poles or sticks or the devil's shoulders, and they're flying two and three to a broomstick, through a stick through the air to this meeting from as far away as Connecticut, in fact. And they're flying often with their families. I mean, that's the other rather appalling thing about Salem, is that you have children accusing mothers and grandmothers, and often they will be flying with their families on these poles.
Well, I mean, what do you attach any kind of importance to the fact that that emerges in Salem, and it didn't seem to be something that the Swedish witches talked about?
Well, I'm afraid that I do blame Cotton Mather for that little piece of
yes?
it. Cotton Mather is the person who imports the story of the Swedish epidemic to Massachusetts in a best-selling book a few years earlier. So the imagery of that that invasion, that diabolical moment, which also is caused, I should add, by a 9 and 11-year-old child, so it's very similar in its origins, and many people are, in fact, persecuted in the Swedish witchcraft, that imagery should then be transferred wholesale to Massachusetts does seem to be a Cotton Mather contribution to this particular story. And what he doesn't mention, what he leaves out of his account, but was in the Swedish account, never makes it to Massachusetts, so it seems particularly suspect.
He seems to want it always. I mean, he urges caution, but if I remember right, he doesn't deny the idea that there are angels and creatures around, right?
He's a very brilliant young 29-year-old minister.
Is he a manipulative person too, would you say, or not?
I would not say he is manipulative. I'd say he's a fluent and complex thinker.
Okay.
Supple, you might say. So that in a document, he's repeatedly appealed to because he is so brilliant. I mean, this is a man who had graduated from Harvard at 11 and preached his first sermon, gone to Harvard at 11 and preached his first sermon at 16. And he's regularly appealed to by the authorities for advice on witchcraft and on the prosecution. And in the space of a single document, he's able to go from advising caution and moderation to making a case for serious and hasty prosecution. So there is a sort of, as it was later said of him, ambidextrousness to the advice. He is able to argue it from both sides.
What would have been his motive?
Well, this idea that New Englanders are the chosen people certainly is part of it. He will afterward, in 1693, he will write something that I'm surprised hasn't sort of stood out more in the literature. It's a very indicting statement, never meant to be published, but does come out, in which he basically will say months after the witchcraft court has shut down and everyone else is a little bit appalled by what has happened, he'll say, but really, nothing was lost in 1692. We filled the pews. God got new recruits. We awakened a slumbering generation. The devil got absolutely nothing, wholly forgetting the 20 innocent victims. So it is clear that it has not, and he's still, by the way, in 1693, taking the pulse of witchcraft cases, because the belief in witchcraft will not die in 1692. The idea that the court is infallible will perhaps take a hit. You know, he's very involved in this. The idea that there is an invisible world and that there are devils afoot is really inseparable for most New England ministers, and certainly for Cotton Mather, from the very idea of faith.
And I want to talk about that in a minute, but I made a little note here. At one point, Mather uses prayer to get rid of a son-in-law that he doesn't like. I mean, I asked you if he was manipulative because there were times when it seemed like he would embrace this kind of thing for his own ends.
There's a part in the book where I realized you had to address how superstition and magic and religion differ from each other.
Right.
Because they did, even to the 17th century New Englander, bleed into each other quite a bit. And what is the difference between putting a spell on someone or someone's oxen or someone's cattle and someone wishing that his son-in-law would drop dead, which he does, and not wishing, praying that his son-in-law will drop dead,
right,
which he does. So I'm afraid I used that a little bit against Con Mather. I hope I'll be forgiven.
But I want you to talk a little bit more about the intersection of religion and magic and witchcraft.
What the trials will uncover is an enormous amount of superstition. Many people in court will admit, when they're confessing to things, will admit to the use of magic. One Andover farmer, male farmer, who's accused is a professional fortune teller. And in fact, when he is called upon to confess, will make very clear that he spent more time reading palms and telling fortunes when he should have been tending his cattle. So that's the blot on his conscience, basically. And many men in the community there will admit they've spent too much time listening to him tell fortunes when they should have been tending their farms. Even initially, when the girls first begin to convulse and are believed to be bewitched, a neighborhood woman who belongs to the church will come by and she'll try a folk remedy, a superstitious remedy, on the girls to see if she can somehow identify who the witch is. So, as scholars have pointed out, there is a whole overlay here of superstition and of sort of mystical belief that coexists with this this fervent piety.
Although you were careful to say at the beginning of the discussion that witchcraft is, these witches were not based in superstition. I mean, they were, again, tangible.
The witchcraft belief is pure religion. And the idea that a witch exists is as clear to these people as the idea that heat or light exists. I mean, the devil has a palpable presence. The devil is in confederacy with witches. And that is as irrefutable as is the existence of God.
How often are you going to hear that from the stage of the Fitzgerald Theater?